Hello, I'm Andy Crosby.
And I'm James Ogden, and you're listening to The Assist. This week we're talking about vulnerability, which I know is a passion and a something that's really important to both me and Andy in our personal lives and our work lives. I think too often vulnerability is misunderstood, and you can't talk about vulnerability without talking about Brené Brown, and she's sort of everywhere now, and her original TED talk talked a lot about vulnerability and tried to get us to understand vulnerability, and she re-clarifies it in her Netflix special, and that there is lots of misunderstanding around it, especially when she goes out and speaks to business leaders about vulnerability and how they actually employ it in their lives and in their work. And that actually most people falsely assume that vulnerability is kind of knowing that you might fail and still trying and actually then you succeed, but you still tried even though you knowing that you might fail. Whereas vulnerability is trying when you know you're going to fail. Andy, what springs to mind when you hear vulnerability?
Oh, I've got a funny story about this in that, so referring to Brené Brown, I think the first book of Brené's that I read was Daring Greatly.
Yeah.
And I read it and loved it and lent it to my wife afterwards. My wife was enjoying it. And she was reading it at work one day when a colleague of hers asked, what's that you're reading? And she showed the book and she explained what it was about. And she said, you know, it's about the importance of being vulnerable and as a leader, making yourself vulnerable. And my wife's colleague turned around and said, I don't think that's right. I think you need to be tough, not vulnerable. And that's how you succeed in the workplace. And for anybody who's read that book or any of Brené's books or seen anything that she's ever done, you'll understand the irony in that, because the position that Brené's essentially arguing against is this view that you need to be tough, and toughness is what is required for success. And the flip side of that is that vulnerability is weakness. Vulnerability equals weakness, which is bad. So invulnerability equals toughness, which is good. Funny to have that just represented so succinctly by my wife's colleague there.
Yeah, and I think it's such a, I mean, I've seen it so much in the workplace. I think it's one of the things that I would diagnose within the best teams that I've been a part of, are that they're full of leaders, but not just leaders, full of also people within those teams that are comfortable with the discomfort of vulnerability. And I think that's the real crux of it, actually, is that these people that do believe that you need to be tough to be successful in the workplace, a lot of it, I think, stems from a discomfort of the fact that, you know, things like trust and belonging are things that can be really, really uncomfortable for people because there's so much uncertainty and lots of people, and Brené Brown herself, you know, talks about how she was brought up to be like really tough and really struggled with vulnerability for a long time herself, and struggled with the kind of the empirical knowledge that vulnerability is needed for success and, you know, to have a full and happy life. So I think that's it's rife, that belief about wanting to be tough, and actually it's rife in all of us. You know, I'm not saying that I'm perfect at all in that sense. I think you try and you are intentional to be vulnerable, but actually lots of the time you will stop yourself and you'll think, actually I shouldn't do this because I should be tough and there should be some more certainty, and the world of work is so built up to get you to do that. I think there are so many places where, you know, you'll have leaders above you who don't necessarily trust, and you think that that's not a good thing to do, and you often have to really try to be vulnerable.
Yeah, the phrase that's in my head is be professional.
Yeah.
And so often we're encouraged to be professional, and what that actually means is hide your emotion.
Yeah.
Deny you have any emotion, put on a mask. One of the things that I find really interesting about this particular point in history that we're living through, and at the risk of time stamping this podcast, we're in the middle of the COVID-19 lockdown at the moment, is that be professional expectation is fraying, is shattering, I think, at the moment, when so many of us are working from home and denied the sort of everyday social interactions that we've actually come to depend on, and just dealing with such an uncertain situation. so many people have been feeling some sense of anxiety to greater or lesser degrees, and it seems to have become more acceptable to actually express that to work colleagues, certainly. I mean, that's been my experience, James. I don't know if you've seen any of that.
So I think, I totally agree. And we should stop talking about Brené Brown at some point. And although I think we'll probably reference her all the way through. I saw a tweet from her at the start of the lockdown. And there's all these things in the workforce at the moment about, you know, these memes and GIFs about how every Zoom call starts. And I think one of the things that people have that's been really hard, I think, is this comparative suffering piece, which is that people sort of say, oh, I'm doing okay. You know, things could be a lot worse. And actually that's kind of intertwined with the vulnerability thing. The tweet from Brené Brown said that comparative suffering is dangerous at this time, because when you don't honor your own struggle, you don't give people the chance to feel like their struggle is valid as well. Mm-hmm. And actually that's why I think in the workplace, vulnerability is really important, especially at this time, because it's a vicious cycle. If you aren't vulnerable, then other people think that that's the way to be. And that kind of professional, in inverted commas, attitude that you were talking about there just bleeds into everything. And it stops people from being human. And I think then it starts to stop all those other things that are really difficult and uncomfortable things to have, like, you know, joy at work and feeling belonging to a team because you know people. And actually what I found in the lockdown actually is that I agree is that you are getting more of that almost out of necessity, that people are kind of finding out what other people's homes look like and having their dogs and their cats sit on their shoulders and actually where vulnerability is being forced a little bit at the moment. And I think that's a really good thing.
So one of the things I think we've done reasonably well so far is we've described the opposite of vulnerability. We've described what invulnerability looks and feels like. Mm. But this notion of vulnerability in the workplace, so how would you describe that? Or do you have a story that you think exemplifies that quite well?
I think the thing I would say is that I've not worked under many leaders who are willing to talk about their struggle in their personal lives. Mm-hmm. And I actually think that's something that's quite powerful. It's a really dangerous, I think people perceive it as a really dangerous thing to do, to kind of open your door to your personal life and to talk about the things you're going through. And it's definitely going back to invulnerability, there are plenty of people who will keep it very close to their chest and keep it very quiet. But I think that actually, I think there's going to be lots of personal reflections in this podcast. And for me, a personal reflection for me is that a few years ago, I was going through a really difficult period and I did not, I hid the whole thing really in the workplace and did not talk about it, did not kind of honor my own struggle, like I was talking about before. Yeah. And it became really unhealthy for me. I threw myself into work and into that professional mode and then flamed out and had a couple of weeks off sick, which I never thought I would do with stress, basically. And going through something really difficult in the last sort of year as well in my personal life, I've been much more open with it at work. And I think it's been a personal journey for myself and actually being open with people and talking about things a bit more than I used to. But in this case, I have been a bit more open with people who I lead. And what that's led to, I think, is that, you know, I don't often blow my own trumpet for people who don't know me, but I think what it has led to is an atmosphere of trust and belonging within my team, and people feel that they can admit mistakes and even in work, and can feel that they are able to be honest about where they need to be better and where the organization needs to be better. And it's creating a really, really positive atmosphere. Have you got any kind of examples yourself?
One thing that immediately springs to mind is a story of a former manager of mine who I really liked. I enjoyed working with, but he gave me a bit of advice once, which was, with the people that you're leading, it's okay to be friendly, but not friends with them. And I think I was quite young at the time, and so that advice stuck with me. I'm not saying I necessarily followed it, but it certainly lodged in my head. But over the next few years, as I gathered more experience of managing and just more experience of people and life, I actually came to feel that I disagreed with what he was saying. Now, I don't particularly want to get deep into this example about whether it's okay to be friends with the people that you manage. My view is yes, but that shouldn't necessarily be a goal of yours. But this idea of friendly, not friends, is that idea of putting down actually quite hard boundaries, but they seem to be not necessarily useful boundaries. I think they're quite self-protective boundaries, in that it's basically saying, I'm going to be your manager, but I'm not actually going to be a human being in that. I'm going to be friendly, so I'm not going to be unpleasant, but I'm not going to show you the reality of who I am. I'm not going to open up to you, I guess is a way to put it. I really like the phrase that you've used a few times about honouring your own struggle. And obviously it's not just like what you're talking about is not just about honouring your own struggle, it's about sharing your own struggle as well. And I'm fairly confident that this view of it's okay to be friendly but not friends means that you shouldn't share your own struggle, because that's something that friends would do, but not something a friendly manager would do.
Yeah, I completely agree. And I think that attitude of you should be friendly but not friends is something that you're a little bit older than me, but we're kind of the same sort of age bracket. And it feels like it's a pervading thing for millennials going into the world of work, from leftover from perhaps an attitude of some of maybe our older colleagues. And then actually I just disagree with it fundamentally. I think that I've seen it go like both ways. I think there are managers who, leaders that I've worked with, who I know are passionate humans and are able to build relationships really naturally.
Yeah.
And when they're told that they should be friendly but not friends, and that there should be boundaries that are set, those people are able to still create atmospheres by accident that are helpful and are trusting. But where it's really dangerous is when people who aren't necessarily as adept at building relationships are told that, they then create real hard structures and boundaries that can be really, really not conducive to success and to good teams and to feeling like you belong to the team. And I also think that it's a really hard thing to hold the line on as a leader, because there are so many people out there with that attitude who haven't challenged it. And I think it's fair, because you, like, if you haven't challenged it yourself and tried something else, then you don't actually see the benefit of not having those boundaries set. And I think you're right, it isn't about setting out to be friends with people, absolutely not, but love should be a part of the workplace, I think. Mm-hmm. And when you set boundaries in that way, it's really difficult. And I think it goes down through organizations, and then you end up, by not honoring your own struggle and by not having that, you stop other people from feeling like they can do it, and you make other people set boundaries, and it ends up infecting the whole organization.
One of my all-time favorite articles about leadership is in the Harvard Business Review, and I think it's called The Four Surprising Qualities of Inspirational Leaders. And it's based on research of hundreds of real-life leaders that other people say they find inspiring. And that being the research frame, I really like, because it obviously fits very much with the motivating principle of this podcast. And the article says that there are unsurprising qualities of successful leaders. So, you know, these people have a vision for the future and they're good at setting strategic direction and that sort of thing. But the article focuses on these four under-the-radar qualities that the people who they lead collectively say transform them from being good to being inspiring. And these four qualities are, the first one is they reveal their differences. They both show and capitalize about what's unique about themselves. And in doing that, they help to give other people permission to do the same. The second one is they rely heavily on intuition to gauge when and how to act. So it's not formulaic, it's very much responsive to what they see and feel from people. The third thing is they manage people with what's called tough empathy. So they engage with people in a way that's both passionate and realistic. And the fourth one, which is the one I'm getting to, shockingly enough, is that they selectively show their weaknesses. By exposing some vulnerability, they actually reveal their humanity and make themselves approachable in a way that then ripples throughout the organization.
And that just resonates so strongly with me, with organizations that I've worked in that have been properly functioning. You see it at all levels. And I've worked also with people who I think don't necessarily, I think the vulnerability element of it is really important, because you do get this kind of, you do get leaders who are very good at building trust and appear to be very good at building trust and are very good at building relationships with people and making people feel comfortable. But actually they never really do that. They never really build a complete trust, mm-hmm. because they're not talking about their own weaknesses. They're not talking about their own struggles. They are just artificially creating a nice atmosphere, nice in inverted commas. And so the vulnerability side of it is so important. And I think people don't, I think it's a very underrated and underappreciated thing. I think it's something that people just don't recognize as important to good leadership. And the thing about it is it goes back to the second of the four points you talked about, which is if you don't do that weaknesses, you don't talk about your weaknesses, you don't talk about your own struggle, then what that then means is that other people, there isn't that capacity for trust. There isn't, people don't feel, oh, I've forgotten what your second point was.
I can't remember either, but I've got two points in my notes, which I think are really relevant here, which I want to drop in. I'll give you the notes and then I'll unpack them a little bit. So the first one is vulnerability is connective, which I think is really, that embodies what you've just been talking
exactly
about.
Exactly what I was talking about. Yeah.
Yeah. And the second note is denying the elephant.
Okay.
So
I love elephants, by the way. I was talking yesterday on a Zoom call with a Zoom drinks thing, and we were asking about what our favorite children's books were. And I realized that most of them were elephant books. Elmer the Elephant.
I totally know what I'm getting you for your next birthday then. Not an actual elephant, by the way. We don't stretch quite that far. So if we recall back to the episode on hope, I was talking about this model of motivation about a rider perched atop an elephant, and the rider is our rational side, and the elephant represents the emotional side. The idea is that we tend to think of ourselves as rational beings who make considered decisions and act on the basis of our considered decisions. But the reality is that our rational bit is this tiny figure perched atop this great big elephant. And the rider can only exercise a small amount of control and influence over the elephant. And if the rider tries to direct the elephant to go somewhere that the elephant really doesn't want to go, the elephant ain't going to go there. And I think that when we're talking about invulnerability, actually what we're doing is people are denying that they have an elephant. I love that phrase just because I love the picture. I love the visual image and just how big the elephant is, but also just then how much of themselves people are denying, which then if I loop back to this idea of vulnerability being connective. So that article I just referenced refers to how by people making themselves vulnerable, it actually allows other people to make themselves vulnerable and to talk more openly about what they're struggling with. And through talking more open about what they're struggling with, actually often getting help to move past the struggles. The thing about invulnerability and being professional, there are two sort of metaphors I like here. One is putting on a mask, but the other is putting up barriers. And if we are all 90% elephant, which means we have a whole raft of complicated emotional needs, but we're putting up a barrier between ourselves and others about both sharing those emotional needs and actually getting any help and support in meeting those needs, we're denying ourselves the very support that we need in order to be successful, in order to achieve, in order to thrive.
And that get the being successful and being able to thrive, the kind of the getting better element of this, because we every time we do these podcasts, we have Andy sends us some topics and bullet points, and one of his bullet points for this one was failure, and I think this is an apt moment to sort of reference it outwardly, which is that failure is really important for success. Failure before success is very important, and that's you know, it's evident in all kinds of areas I can think of in my time in work, where the first few failures are really important for how big the success will be at the end of it. And I think vulnerability, what you've been talking about with vulnerability being connective, is really important, because if you don't honor your own struggle, as I've already mentioned, and you're not vulnerable about it, and you're not able to allow others to then be vulnerable, you aren't going to be able to, when you as a leader talk to someone about their failure, it's not going to be fully helpful. If you don't create that atmosphere where people can be completely and utterly honest and transparent about why they failed and how they failed, then you're never going to be able to help them to a success point in the future. Or if you do, it's not going to be as effective as it could be, because at some point they inevitably will guard or protect some part of that failure that they see as being something that can't be forgiven. And it's probably because you haven't, as a leader, been open and vulnerable about how you failed in the past, and completely about how you failed in the past. And so they don't feel that they can be as open, and they have to hide something from you. And so it's either going to take you longer to get them to success, or it's not going to be as successful once they get there. So the connectiveness thing is just so important within teams. And we talked a lot about, you know, over the past few podcasts about self-managing teams and things. And that's why I mentioned leader and team a lot, but actually it's really important throughout a team, not just from leadership. It's important that everybody within the team sets and models that, especially when it can be very toxic sometimes to be vulnerable, you know, to you. It's really easy to be cynical in the world of work about vulnerability. It's really easy for people to play the professionalism card and to stop you from doing that and sharing and creating an atmosphere where people feel able to share more of themselves. It's really hard, I think, sometimes to push those feelings away from other people.
Yeah, one of the things that what you just said made me think of is the notions of perfection and imperfection. Yeah. And how this idea of professionalism, I think, links to the notion of perfection, that you should avoid mistakes, you should aim to do a perfect job all the time, and that's what success is, that's what it means to be successful. And obviously that's utter bollocks. And actually recognizing that imperfection is what leads to growth. If it were possible for you to be perfect now, to do something perfectly, there's nowhere for you to go and there's nothing for you to learn from. There's no way to develop. But it's also entirely unrealistic to think that we're ever going to be perfect. And that's why the role of failure, of getting it wrong and being open about that and being able to learn from that is so incredibly important. I'm reminded of the famous Michael Jordan quote about failure. I assume you know the one I'm talking about. Yeah. So for those people who aren't as au fait with random basketball quotes as me and James, Michael Jordan once said, "I've missed more than 9,000 shots in my career. I've lost almost 300 games. 26 times I've been trusted to take the game-winning shot and missed. I've failed over and over and over again in my life, and that is why I succeed." Failure is what helps us get better.
Yeah.
At the risk of digressing too much along this point, I find myself...
I don't think you are digressing, because I think it's a really important... It's such an important point. And perfectionism, it's a way for people to avoid blame. Mm-hmm. And I think it's... I think what Brené Brown would say, that it's a form of shame in and of itself, perfectionism, that actually you're kind of trying to earn approval. And it's the thing I was talking about before, that if you as a leader or as a team member don't talk about your own imperfections within what you've done, it breeds a really unhealthy attitude of distrust, and then where you can't be the best that you can be because you're always striving for perfection. Nobody likes perfection. You know, nobody trusts perfection. Yeah. Like, you can project the image of perfection, but actually it just continues to hurt the cycle of trust, of distrust, because nobody thinks that you're perfect, so they start looking for the bits that weren't perfect in what you did, when actually you could be honest about them and then get help with the things that genuinely were imperfections and help yourself.
I often feel that the illusion of perfection is quite aspirational. It's something that we're drawn to, but it is an illusion. Whereas the reality of imperfection, I think, is really connective. I think when we see people struggling to do things or getting things wrong, it actually helps us to empathize. It makes us think about the times when we've struggled, and the times where we've got things wrong, and how that felt. And it actually helps us put ourselves in other people's shoes. Whereas if people are trying to project this picture of perfection, I mean, who of us has an experience of being perfect?
Yeah. And you know, look in popular culture. You know, what are the shows that people are drawn? TV shows that people are drawn to. You know, one of the most popular TV shows of the past decade, and TV show that I love, is Game of Thrones. And Game of Thrones is full of imperfect characters, full of people who you root for not because of their perfections, but because of their imperfections, and then they die.
And therein is a lesson. No, but yeah. that's not the lesson we're trying to learn.
Be imperfect. Yeah. You'll get decapitated. I think it shows through all of the most sort of successful television shows and films over the last few years is that people relate to imperfection. They relate to that because everybody is. And if you try and project some false image of perfection when you're in work, it's just as similar, just the same as a TV show that fails because its main character is perfection.
Yep. And that's the thing, right? Like every dramatic arc is based on characters' struggle, characters overcoming struggle and growing, and never achieving perfection, but struggle. Struggle is the heart of drama.
Yeah. Intention and obstacle, as Aaron Sorkin would say, our hero.
I kind of wanted to come back to this idea of vulnerability as connective. And then after that, I'd like us to go to actually this looking at how it feels to be vulnerable, because I think that's really important. We haven't really dug into that enough. There's a phrase I've come across in a whole bunch of places, but it describes human beings, describes us as being hardwired to connect. Have you come across this phrase before? I assume it makes sense to you.
It does, yeah.
So there's a few examples of this from a book on attachment theory, which is called Hold Me Tight, which I just want to share briefly. So people are hardwired to connect. I think understanding the way that human beings, like we're not separate entities in the way we tend to think of ourselves. We are social beings, and the connections between us are very real and very powerful. So here are a couple of examples to illustrate that. So in an experiment where women were receiving an MRI brain scan, they were told that when a red light came on, they might receive a small electric shock on their feet, or they might not. Now, just receiving this information lit up the stress centers of their brain. So anticipating an electric shock made people feel more stressed. But when their partner was there, holding their hand, the patients actually registered less stress than when they were going through this experience alone. And then when they actually did receive an electric shock, they physically experienced less pain. A secure connection, the presence of somebody who we are securely bonded to, can literally act as a buffer against shock, stress, and pain, which I think is just quite an incredible story. A second phenomenon is this idea of transactive memory. Have I talked to you about transactive memory before, James?
You haven't, no.
No, okay, right. So not everything we remember is stored within our own head. As human beings, this sounds really weird, but I love it. As human beings, we also store information within other people. So couples in long-term relationships do this automatically. And if you're Georgie, my wife, one of the things you store in my head is where exactly she put her keys or her wallet or her phone. When people know each other, they create an implicit joint memory system based on an understanding of who's best suited to remember what kind of things. So in terms of my relationship with Georgie, Georgie is really good at remembering conversations. She will remember details of what we talked about from months and years ago that I have no memory about at all. But I'm really good at remembering physical locations of things. So it's funny, part of one of my roles in the relationship is literally finding stuff for Georgie. Because that's the way my brain works. I'm just able to picture where the things are. And they've done experiments around this concept of transactive memory. So in these experiments, pairs of people were asked to read a number of statements, each of which had one word highlighted. They're then asked as a pair to recall as many of the highlighted words as possible at the end of this. And pairs of people who knew each other consistently remember substantially more words than pairs of people who do not know each other.
I think, I don't know about you, maybe you have some examples of that, but I just feel that connectiveness is what makes successful teams in works.
Yeah,
in work. Sorry, what were you going to say?
No, I'm violently agreeing with you yet again.
we do that probably too much. We should do an episode on conflict at some point.
we'd agree about that as well.
And, yeah, we would. I think, yeah, it's just a characteristic of all of the great teams I've been a part of, is that connectedness, is the feeling of, it goes back to that friendly friend thing again. And I think, you know, that can sometimes maybe blur the picture, which is actually that just people who know each other really well aren't necessarily friends. They often are in that scenario, which is why it's sometimes people are cynical about those type of teams. But just the most high functioning teams I've been a part of. I had a colleague that I joined an organization with at the same time, and we were sort of similar sort of age and background, and we're doing the same job, and we joined together, and sort of because of lots of shared experiences, like going to London together for inductions and team days and stuff, and we spent lots of time together, and it helped that we liked each other, but it was a really high functioning professional relationship, the best I've ever had. And it was because of that connectiveness. It was because we knew each other so well that we were able to fit like a glove, really, and do things. It was two people doing genuinely two jobs, but we ended up probably with the output of three people, not because either of us were particularly great at what we did. It's just that the way we were so connected was able to help us play to each other's strengths and do more. It's so important. And the problem, I think, for a lot of people, and when we start, it'll be interesting, I think we should talk more about how it feels to be vulnerable. I think how it feels to be invulnerable is very comfortable. And it's easy to slip back into that, and to the, mm-hmm. the connectiveness, those boundaries that we were talking about before. When you put those boundaries up, it's an easier thing to do than to be connected to people. It's easier to put a boundary up and to hold the line there. It's hard to build those connections because you're faced with choices all of the time about whether you should really be in that relationship, and you should, like, the things that you should do. You know, you're constantly challenged with those thoughts that I think are inbred within us from an early work age of like, oh, well, maybe one day I'm going to manage this person and it'd be really uncomfortable to be friends with them and to have this kind of relationship.
Yeah.
And that stuff is hardwired into us, and it's really hard to go against that. But if you challenge it and you do go against it, you'll find that, you know, the amount of times in my life I've ended up managing people that I was friends with, you know, people that I was a peer with, that I was friends with, which is, I think, is accepted more within the workplace that you would be friends with a peer.
Yeah.
That I've ended up managing them. And it's the same situation I'm currently in at the moment. I manage a couple of my really close work friends, and it's not a problem. It really isn't.
Yep.
Like, it just does feel like a total myth, really.
So a couple of things on that. So this idea of be professional, it's sort of underpinned by this, like, really destructive, I think, belief that healthy, mature adult is not supposed to need emotional connection. I think that's the sort of implicit justification or whatever. But I think that what you've said is actually the reality of it, which is denying your emotion and concealing your imperfection is easier. It's safer because being vulnerable is hard. But in doing that, you are actually making things harder for other people because you're denying them these really important emotional connections. And you're actually making things harder for yourself. It feels easier, but what you're doing is denying yourself emotional connection. And when we struggle, emotional connection is what helps us. One of the things I've got here in my notes is the best predictor of the impact of any trauma is not actually the severity of the event, but the degree to which we can seek and take comfort from others. One of the things people hear me say quite often is that resilience is not a property of individuals, but it's a property of communities. We often think about resilience as being, you know, your ability to pick yourself up once you've been knocked down. But how easy it is for you to pick yourself up is a factor of the support you get from the people around you. We are all connected, whether those are healthy or unhealthy connections. And if we try to present this perfect, polished, professional image, that's a little bit too alliterative, I apologise. You may need an avalanche of Advil to get over that.
I know. And I'm disappointed that you couldn't think of a P for image as well, the perception maybe.
Yeah. Totally lost where I was going with that one. So I'm just
I mean, we've got to make it entertaining at some point.
Yeah. I just want to divert then to something else which I've got in front of me, which is, this is an American example, which I think I've taken from a book called Why Do I Need a Teacher When I've Got Google? I think that's where it's from. It says a patient's decision about whether or not to sue a doctor depended on the extent to which the patient liked their doctor. So it's actually not about the quality of medical care that they receive. People don't sue doctors that they like. So there's obviously this term within medical profession about bedside manner. Doctors with good bedside manner get sued less often than doctors with bad bedside manner, regardless of the quality of the medical advice they provide, because it's these connective skills that actually help us. This ability to forge connections actually helps both parties. It makes both people stronger.
Yeah, and I think that the what's important with that as well is that as I've gone through work and I've started to appreciate the importance and the value of that connectivity between people, I've started to not blur the lines, but I've started to share more about myself and my own misgivings and my own weaknesses and actual personal weaknesses and personal struggles. And I don't just mean talking about things that are going on in my personal life. I mean sharing about genuinely reflections about myself and where I can be better and what I could do differently as a person. Yeah. And actually that, as I do more of that, I find my relationships at work being even more positive and feeling more connected. And you're right that, you know, the heart of all of this is, you know, like we've said, which is that humans crave contact and love with other humans. Yep. It's just the way we're built, and you spend a lot of your time at work. Mm-hmm. You know, a lot of your time, so why would you deny yourself that in a such a large portion of your life? It just now seems bonkers.
Yeah,
to me.
Well, I think we know the answer, which is where we were going to move on to anyway, which is what yeah. does it feel like to be vulnerable, to make yourself vulnerable? Yeah. There's a quote from Brené Brown to drop in here, but let's actually talk about our own experiences as well. So Brené's phrase is, vulnerability sounds like truth and feels like courage.
And I think the other thing to drop in from Brené Brown here is the, because I don't know about you, but I do know about you because you talked about the elephant example, and I know you anyway, but I like imagery and I like seeing things in an abstract way in an image. And the quote that she uses from Teddy Roosevelt often is really powerful for me, because it actually is it's almost like a thing that you should do. I can imagine myself, and the quote, you know, I advise you to go and listen to Brené Brown anyway and listen to the quote, but the quote is from Teddy Roosevelt about it's called The Man in the Arena, and it's about that the credit belongs, I'll read verbatim here, the credit belongs to the man who is actually in the arena, whose face is marred by dust and sweat and blood, who strives valiantly, who at the best knows the triumph of high achievement, and who at the worst, if he fails, at least fails while daring greatly. And the thing for me with that is the power of the imagery of how it feels to be vulnerable, which is kind of on your knees in an arena full of people, all of whom aren't being vulnerable. Yeah. And are sat in the cheap seats, and you're there with sweat and blood and dust on your face, and you're on your knees. Yeah. And that is how vulnerability feels. Yeah. When you're genuinely doing it, it just really captures the essence of it really powerfully for me. And actually it helps me to think about when I'm trying to be vulnerable, because I think it's something you should be intentional about. Mm-hmm. It helps to be able to think about putting myself in the arena. I start to think, am I really here? Am I really in the middle of the arena? Is my face marred by blood, sweat and tears? If this is how am I genuinely being vulnerable? Yeah. And that's really hard.
Yeah.
Because it's also about that being seen thing, and the fact that there is an audience full of people in the cheap seats who could hurl stuff at you, and that happens so often in work. Mm. I've come across it so much in my time in work, where people are so quick to throw stones at my house that I'm trying to build. Yeah. Where I'm trying to build a house with people who love being at work and feel that it's fun and have connection with their teammates and don't feel the need to, you know, always be professional and always be productive, because actually some of the things the things you're doing can sometimes seem like they're not actually professional. You might, in this scenario at the moment, you might start a Zoom meeting with 10, 15 minutes of talk about how things are going in your day. And actually that's extremely valuable. Yeah. In terms of building those connections. But there are plenty of people in the cheap seats who are willing to say that's not okay, and that you shouldn't be like that. and it's really hard to hold your ground.
I'm reminded of a different former manager of mine who called me up after a meeting that I'd been leading that she wasn't in, but apparently somebody had reported back to her. And this manager told me that I didn't know how to run a meeting. And the reason for that was because I didn't have bullet point agenda items with time allocated, and I wasn't relentlessly driving people through agenda item after agenda item. Because what I actually felt was that the relationships within the group needed attention. People needed more time to get to know one another, to understand one another better, and to build those connections. So what I had tried to do in this particular meeting was just create that space, create space for people to express more about themselves and their perspective and to listen and hear one another. And I was, again, I was quite young at this time. It was all very instinctive. It wasn't anything I had specifically planned. I was feeling my way. So I didn't know how to respond to this person saying that I don't know how to run a meeting. It actually took me quite a few years to reflect on and process that and to come to the point of view that actually I disagree with her. I remember talking to my dad about this, and my dad just laughing and saying, there is no one way to run a meeting. Meetings can be held for so many different purposes that they require different styles and approaches.
Yep.
That feedback I got, you don't know how to run a meeting. Like, in terms of being in the arena, like, the person who gave me that feedback wasn't even in the meeting. but had such a fixed idea of, I guess, what good looked like. Also gave me no opportunity to actually explain what I was trying to do.
I love there's a bit in the Brené Brown Netflix special where she says, like, you know, you should only really allow into your kind of psyche the people who are in the arena with you. Like, you've not got time for the shit of those people who aren't even in the meeting. It's not okay. And it's not valid. And sometimes it can be really easy to then, when you don't necessarily take that feedback because you don't agree, it's really easy for those people in the cheap seats to then say, oh, you just can't take feedback then, can you? Which again is just not, it's just a further indication of them not being in the arena with you.
Yeah. But I think you've touched on a really interesting challenge here, because with us all being social beings and with us having an emotional elephant, we are interested in the opinions of others.
Yeah.
And actually that process of allowing ourselves to be shaped and affected by the opinions of others, but to be more discerning about which opinions we allow to influence us, that kind of feels just like a description of what life is and what it is to develop as a healthy adult. And it's challenging, isn't it? Because it's not simply the case that you should exclude those perspectives that are different from your own. In fact, that's really problematic. You've already referenced conflict and how important conflict actually is in the workplace and more widely than that. So it's not this criterion of whether or not people agree with you, but it's this thing about, I guess, whether people are trying, whether people are in the sand, in the arena. And I guess maybe they're fighting with you in the arena, if we continue the metaphor. But the fact that they're in the arena rather than jeering at you from the cheap seats is what's significant.
Yeah, and I think the overwhelming feeling for me is that it's really hard to be vulnerable, and it's really hard, especially hard when so many organizations I've been a part of have not encouraged that, and it's not been the norm that is pervades across the whole organization. It's been a pocket of the organization that you have to protect, and it feels like that's why the arena metaphor really resonates with me, because it's, I think often when I've been in teams that have been like that, they've been the small bit, like the one lonely person in the middle of the arena with the rest of the organization being in the seats looking in, thinking, well, I shouldn't be doing this. This is not the way to do it. When I first was introduced to Brené Brown, it was liberating for me, because it just showed me that I loved that there was science behind the assertion that I always had the assertion that I've built throughout my work life that this is really valuable.
Yeah, for me, this stuff is stuff that I've certainly had to learn. I remember when I was 18, I took a gap year and I went to Canada. I spent a year in Canada and the States. And in Myers-Briggs terms, I'm a T, not an F, which means I'm focus on and motivated by ideas more than by relationships, which I remember the first time I shared that fact with you, James, you were quite shocked because you're an F, you're motivated fundamentally by relationships, and because we have so much in common and you've seen what my practice is like in an organization as well, you thought, this has to be a guy who's fundamentally motivated by relationships. One of the things that I discovered about myself in that year in Canada is actually how much I needed emotional support. I'd always been kind of closed up to that point, but there's a story that my dad tells, which I think is quite funny, which is, I was in Canada, he's at home with my mum, and he comes into the room at some point, and my mum's on the phone and asks, who are you on the phone to? And she says, I'm on the phone to Andy. So that's fine, right. So Andy goes away, and he comes back into the room maybe an hour later, and my mum's on the phone, and he says, who are you on the phone to now? And my mum mouths, it's still Andy. And my dad's really shocked at this, because prior to going to Canada, I wasn't much of one for long conversations with my parents. But being out there and being, you know, in a unknown country and without any kind of support structure around me, I came to realize, to feel actually how much I needed that emotional support. And that actually led to me, it led to a real deepening of the relationship between myself and my mum, where I came to lean on her much more than I did and was much more open. That's a really particular point, I think, in my journey of coming to understand myself and my emotional needs, but also recognizing how important relationships are, how important looking after people is, which is certainly what I try to bring to my work practice these days.
In the same spirit, I think my what's always interesting for me is that my F definitely influences my work a lot in terms of the Myers-Briggs type. But I think going further than that, I've recently realized that it isn't quite true, is that I like to take care of people, and that taking care of people is something that can sometimes, that caretaking thing can sometimes be really toxic for people when they attach their own self-worth to it. And for a while I thought that was what I did, but actually I don't think it is. I think what I do in my work life, and it also happens in my personal life too, is that I try to hold people up to be the best that they can be. I don't, my kind of attitude at work is I give autonomy thoughtfully, and I allow people to go and do the best work that they can so that they can go and be promoted and go and do bigger and better things. So actually, I don't want to take care of people, because I think the toxic element of caretaking is like always wanting that person to be around you. And actually, that's not the case for me. And actually, the side of that that's really difficult for people who do that, that sort of hold people up, is the fear of failure. And then you end up failing people. And then that can be quite powerful as well. But I think what I was trying to say was that it's something that does come more naturally to me. That kind of the vulnerability and the building connection with people by being open about my own struggle, it comes naturally to me. But even I've struggled with it for years. And so it is something that is just not easy for people. Like it's something that over the last 10 years, I think I've gone in and out of being more vulnerable and less vulnerable, and have, opened myself up to people more and less. And there have definitely been times when I've closed myself off to human connection. And, you know, some of that is the, if we're going back to Myers-Briggs, is the I versus E. And, I'm an introvert, but I desperately need human connection, because everybody does. And so sometimes that makes me close off. So I think everybody struggles with it because of who we are. And the power of Brené Brown's example is how much she struggled with it herself, I think. Yeah.
Really trying to zero in on this idea of what vulnerability feels like.
Yeah.
Your description of being in the arena, that metaphor, I think is really good. And when you were describing that, it made me think about public speaking. So I've worked as a university lecturer before, and I've given quite a few public talks to large groups. And for me, that's actually quite an interesting real life example of actually something that's not dissimilar to the amphitheater in the arena metaphor, where you've got these hundreds of people looking at you. But I also think that given there's such a widespread fear of public speaking, I think it's also quite a helpful example to illustrate what vulnerability feels like. It's too simple to say vulnerability feels like public speaking.
Yeah.
But I think I think public speaking feels vulnerable.
Yeah, and you're right that it's that fear of failure, because I think with public speaking, it's because you're speaking to so many people that inevitably there are going to be people in the room who don't enjoy or don't like you or don't like necessarily agree with what you said, and so you have failed talking to those people. So I think that's why it epitomizes.
Well, I'm gonna disagree. Gonna say that actually you haven't failed.
No,
because that's putting too much responsibility on you at that point, and it's not your failure.
Absolutely not. But I think that's why it feels vulnerable, because I completely agree with you. You haven't failed at all.
There are so many, like you said, there are so many people, and people are so different that to be able to successfully connect with all of them is probably going to be impossible.
Yeah.
And I think the other aspect about this example is that it's live.
Yeah.
You know, if you are talking to 400 people for an hour, you can't just go, you can't do what we do with these podcasts and go back and edit out the bits where we've totally lost our train of thought. Said something really stupid.
You mentioning that completely sprung to my mind the fact that so I do lots of public speaking within my job, and have done for the past sort of five years or so, and speak to rooms of, you know, there was several examples where I've spoken to rooms of well over 100 adults. But I'm also a failed teacher. I tried to be a teacher because I wanted to make a difference to people. I wanted to make an impact in children's lives. I have a strong, and I work for an education charity now that has a strong mission around making sure that every child has the same quality of education regardless of their background. And I know that I had a really great background, a great upbringing, and was able to get, you know, privileges that other people weren't able to get. And so I went to work first as a teaching assistant in a really deprived area of Manchester. And I think I knew deep down, doing that job as a teaching assistant, I think I knew deep down that I was not going to be able to be a teacher. I was utterly petrified at the thought of standing up in front of 30 children. And I can speak in front of lots of adults. It was totally different when you put me in front of a load of kids. Yeah. And I became a different person when I did that. And I still tried to be a teacher after my teaching assistant year. I did my PGCE and I stopped in my PGCE because I just could not do it. I could not put myself in front of 30 children. I fell to pieces before the lesson. I held myself together just about enough for the lesson to get through it, but I wasn't successful in terms of getting pupils to learn. So I think that springs to mind for me because that was one of the most epitomized versions of vulnerability in my life, which was that doing that PGC, I knew I was going to fail. I knew I was going to fail. I could feel it in my bones, but I still did it anyway because it was what I wanted to do. I wanted to make a difference. But it's been so helpful for me in my work life since then, because there are so many experiences from those 2 years that I draw upon now where I failed miserably and knew I was going to fail, but I still draw on those now to this day and help me to be better, I think.
One of the things I'm aware of in these podcasts is that we talk about success and succeeding quite a lot. I think we often think about success too narrowly.
Yeah.
And then actually when we think about success, we need to think about it in terms of health and a range of types of health. So emotional health, physical health, even moral health. But also I think we talk about a lot about growth. And I think you and I both definitely see growth as a key part of actually what succeeding in life is.
Yeah. It's funny. As you were saying that, I started to think growth. And then you said exactly that word. So yeah, I completely agree. And you're right. It is. It does chime with me. There is like a raking feeling when I mention the word success, because it is so hard to define success, and so often it's about hitting targets and that stuff, but actually that's not how I see success. And actually to be fair we did record a whole podcast about winning, where I think we talked a lot about success and a lot about you know, going back to our John Wooden example, where success for John, for the best college basketball coach ever, was not winning games. It was the growth of his players.
There was a job I had years ago in a charity, and I was finding it really hard. I was getting really stressed. Just a very difficult period for me. and there've been a few for me in my life. But I remember talking to my manager at the time, and to try to make me feel better, my manager said, "It's just a job." She said, "Yeah, but basically, don't feel so strongly about it. It's just a job." And in terms of this notion of a healthy life, actually committing my time to doing something that I think is meaningful and is going to make the world better, that's so fundamental to my being. And so her telling me, or trying to tell me, that it's just a job, for me, it showed that she had a very different value set to me, and presumably also that she didn't think of success in the same way that I felt towards success. And it's interesting, like I've said, I was really struggling at this time. I was finding the work very stressful. Part of why I was finding it so stressful is I felt incredibly unsupported in that role. Not surprising if my manager is going to say things to me like, "It's just a job." One of the things I just want to drop in here about vulnerability is just this notion of other people having your back. You've talked quite a bit about how being vulnerable, actually taking that first step, putting yourself out there, helps other people to do so. And in doing that, it builds these connections between people that provide support for all. And within a team context, having those supportive connections between team members actually helps make the team better, makes it more effective, makes it more resilient. For me, this notion of feeling other people have your back is so important to, frankly, to a success, to a happy and productive life, but also in terms of risk, in terms of ability to take risks and try new things. You've talked about vulnerability as not allowing the fact that you know you're going to fail, stopping you doing the thing. And I think a key part of what allows us to do that, what allows us to be vulnerable in that kind of way, is knowing that other people have your back.
Yeah.
It's this weird, like, this sort of meta levels of vulnerability going on that I'm trying to articulate there.
No, I agree. And I think I intentionally try to have people's back to do that in my work life. And, you know, it's really hard. I think it's really hard to have people's back in that sense because of the way we're all built and the way we do things. As you were talking, it made me think of a specific example from quite recently with someone I work with, had a really tough time at work and was had been talking to me about it and just said, you know, I'm after like a few beats had said, "Oh, I'm really sorry. Normally I'm not like this, and it's fine. I'm positive. I'm usually really positive." And it's really easy to just gloss over that comment at the end, but actually it was really important for me to, and I know I don't always do it because I don't always recognize it, but it was really important to then say, do not apologize for that. That is what I want. That is specifically what I want. You know, as a leader of this team, I want you to do that. I want you to talk about that stuff. I want you to honor your struggle. Don't put it away. Don't apologize for it. And if you don't do that, there are times when you have to really do that as part of a team or as the leader of a team to really encourage that behavior. You have to be on high alert all of the time. So it can be hard to find people who have your back to be able to let you do that, especially with what we were talking about earlier around the fact that you're in the arena and there's all these people who disagree with the way you're doing things.
Yeah.
It can be really hard to stand apart from that and to be really principled and to say, "No, I believe in the way I do things," to have people's back.
Yep. I'm reminded of an example of when you and I actually worked together, and this may be an example of me blowing my own trumpet, which I'm much more comfortable doing than James's. But it really stuck with me because it's one of the times I felt I was actually very direct in line managing some people. There were a pair of individuals who I'd recently promoted, and they weren't performing at the level that we needed them to perform within the new role. So what I did is I had a conversation with them actually together, and I said to them, "You're not currently performing at the level we need you to perform." But then I went on to say, "But it's not your fault, and I'll help you to get there." And this example has stuck with me because, like I said, it was actually much more direct than I tend to be in giving that sort of feedback. And the reason I felt able to give such direct feedback is frankly because I was friends with both of these individuals. I had a really good, solid, trusting relationship with both of them. But then the point that you've brought in as well about being in the arena, like the message that, that I was trying to give them, I recognize at that point, was both, I've got your back here, and I'm in the arena with you.
Yeah.
And I'm really pleased. I wouldn't, probably wouldn't be using this example if it hadn't turned out well, but both of those people went on to not only thrive in their roles, but subsequently get further promotions, and they're both just doing so well. And I feel so privileged to have had a role in helping those people develop as human beings.
And isn't it so important, I think, for the genuine success of those processes? Because so often performance management is a euphemism for managing out, in inverted commas, when actually it really should be a genuine attempt to... The first person I ever performance managed years ago was someone who I genuinely really liked. And it was genuinely great that we had this person in the job they were in. It was a male-dominated job and they were female. And it was so important that we kept this person in that job. And the first person that I performance managed, like, it was so important to me that process succeeded. But so often it isn't in the world of work that it's important that it succeeds. And actually, your example there is so powerful, because I think getting in the arena with them is really important to that conversation. Otherwise it just won't succeed. And you're right. It's funny, for people who aren't in our friendship, which is everybody else, when I listen to Andy give examples from work, it's great, because I play a game where I kind of guess, is this from when we worked together? And he reveals different details, and I'm like, is this right? No, it's not. So I play a little game when we do our podcasts, and that's nice.
So there is something else I wanted to drop in before we wrap up this episode, which is just to clarify that this notion of being vulnerable to other people is not the same as letting it all hang out.
Yeah.
I think if we're talking about sharing weakness and imperfection and expressing vulnerability, that isn't an unboundaried concept, that there are still important boundaries there. I'm not going to try and articulate what the boundaries are, but I'll just try and explain what my thought is here. So, I mean, let's take it into an organizational example. If you are sharing emotional difficulties, like if you're trying to offload your emotional difficulties onto other people to get other people to fix them for you, you've gone way too far.
Yeah. Yeah.
And there can be some things which are just too raw to share with particular people at that time.
Yeah.
And again, I just love coming back to this idea of the arena. So if vulnerability is this struggling in the arena, then what that means in this sort of example is sharing something about yourself with others that you're actively trying to work through and asking for their help to work through it with you. So asking them to be in the arena with you. But there are certainly occasions when you try and offload this stuff onto others and then somehow step out of the arena, even though it's about you.
I completely agree. And I think we I suppose have drifted a little during this conversation to talking about different things, but at its essence, if we go back to what we said at the start, vulnerability is being courageous and doing something even though you know you're going to fail. And actually an important part of that, and certainly in the world of work and being vulnerable in the world of work, is the idea about connectivity and doing that and sharing your struggles so that others feel comfortable to share theirs. But just because you place some boundaries on the things that you share doesn't mean that you're not being vulnerable, doesn't mean that you're not building that connectivity. I think it's fine that you don't. And there are plenty of examples in my life when things have been too raw to share in that context. And that doesn't mean that you're not being vulnerable.
Yeah, vulnerability is still about choices.
Yeah.
And requires judgment, because you're going to have different relationships with different people, and people are going to be in different states themselves at different times. So you've got to pick your moments.
Yes.
But you also have to pick some moments and not maintain permanent rigid boundaries between yourself and others. Otherwise you're cutting yourself and them off from so much that is so important in life.
Yeah.
And that feels like a good point to wrap up.
It definitely does. Although, you know, at some point I'm going to have to say something profound to end one of these podcasts. So you've been listening to The Assist. Thanks for listening. If you want to continue the conversation, you can find us on Twitter at The Assist Pod, or if you just want to contact us just in general. Next time, we're going to be talking about conflict and speaking differently. Andy, do you want to tell us a little bit more about that?
Yeah, so as you've heard us say a couple of times in this episode, we really think that conflict is fundamental to both improvement and personal growth, and that speaking differently is a key component to helping people to act differently, because it's what helps to motivate our emotional elephant. So if that's something you want to listen to, then please tune into our next episode, and we'll see you then.
Talk to you next time.